Suranju Hall's reporter, Reel 4. Suranju, you were saying about the regimental exercises when you went out in the desert for a couple of days and the mechanical problems of that. Was it just water or were there other problems?
Lord, yes. I mean, we got pretty good at knowing back axles. The weakness with one hind wheel drive is a frightful strain of back axles. And they got very good, and we learned a great deal about spare parts to take from the lorries. And there's always back axles. And the chaps are bloody good at changing them. Back axles is the weakness of the Rolls-Royce Alpha car. And I suppose we did learn a great deal about weaknesses.
You'd sometimes have to change a whole back axle in the desert, would you?
Yeah. Well, we had our fitters with us, you see. I think that is all, really. I mean, the Rolls was a bloody good thing. It wouldn't go. It was a back axle and boiling.
Did you develop this sand mat thing?
Yes. Yes, we developed the sand mats. And of course, every vehicle, well, I mean, this is old hat now since the desert campaign. But we started all this business of what you had to have in the desert. Shovels, sand mats, and that's about it.
What was a sand mat, in fact?
It's a mat that you rolled out, a canvas mat that you rolled out and put under the wheels. You see, you got stuck. And I can't explain it anymore. Then you put it on, dug down, put it underneath the hind wheels. And the front wheels didn't matter very much. But then you got a bit of a go, got out of it. I can't describe it better than that.
So presumably when you first...
And they had poles too. And now the poles went underneath. Yeah?
Sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah.
So when you first went and did this, then you must have had very bad trouble before you had the sand mats and things.
Well, I think we developed it as we went along, really.
What did you do with the poles? What were they needed for?
Well, the poles actually, when you have double wheels, they put long bamboo poles between them, the double wheels, mostly on the lorries, you see. And they got a grip on that. It was all experimental Kutcher stuff. And I suppose that we, through our sort of experiments, we probably showed the designers what is possible and what isn't. And
you mentioned this as a regimental exercise. Did you at this time take part in the Cairo Command exercises at all?
Yes, I can't remember that very much. I suppose we did, yes. We may have had squadrons. I can't remember. We may have had squadrons. One squadron on one side, and two on the other. But I can't remember. Funny enough, I can't remember the command exercises.
Would you remember any of the Cairo Command people coming out to see you, since this was a new idea?
Oh, Lord, yes. Oh, yes. I mean, they'd all be buzzing around. Jock Burnett Stewart was there. He was commanding. I don't know what happened to him. He was a good soldier, but... I never heard much more of him, but he was a pretty good soldier. No, mind you, I was only a subaltern, so I wouldn't know all these great men. My chief interest, besides soldiering, was playing polo. And polo is a very good exercise. We did have, as I told you, we had a section, that's five cars, detached always down to Alexandria for duties in aid of civil power. and they were attached, but not under command of the local commanders. Various infantry regiments who I stayed with was a good many, and one of them was commanded by Colonel Montgomery, who at that time wasn't very popular with his own soldiers, but it was extraordinary how a few years later he became the idol of the common man. And the only funny thing that happened to me there was that I had to go and draw the soldiers' pay. And I hadn't got my own cars off the road, and we had a government baby Austin, which I could go down and draw the pay, and that was off the road. So I went down in an armoured car to the bank and parked the armoured car with the troops inside it, went and drew the money, came home, and there was all hell to pay. I was rung up by, well, it wasn't Montgomery, it was another battalion commander, said, "What the hell has happened?" He said, "The whole of the middle of Alexandria is in a frightful jitter. They say that an armoured car was down there, and they say that they think that they're going to be rioting, and cotton has dropped 3 points on the bourse." Well, I thought, I explained the situation. I had to get the soldiers paid, and there's nothing else but an armoured car. So it all settled down. I didn't get a rocket, but it shows how frightfully jumpy the jippies were. They were, always were jumpy, the jippies. Yeah.
You mentioned polo then.
Yeah.
You tended to play polo, did you, most days or something, did you?
No. We played polo as a recreation. Rather, the soldiers played football in the afternoon. We played polo 3 days a week.
Did you... how did this work out if you had to go, for example, on a regimental exercise then?
Oh, that worked out all right. That worked all right. Very well, because the soldiers, there was always a good many officers who could weren't playing polo who would conduct the regiment through Cairo safely out of Mena House, and the ones who were playing polo would play polo, jump in a car, and join the regiment in bivouac. When we came back on, that'll be a Monday night, Monday afternoon, and Wednesday, when we'd finished on Wednesday morning with the scheme, well, the same officers would take the regiment back to Helmia, and we could go and play polo in the afternoon while the soldiers slept the sleep of the just. The officers lived a fairly hectic life with what was doing scheme. And you weren't absolutely at your best on the Wednesday afternoon with eyes red from 2 days' sandstorms. Oh, we got by.
Did you play polo with other infantry battalions?
Oh, yes. Well, it was the cavalry brigade and, oh, yes, the infantry brigade, yeah. Oh, Lord, yes. Oh, yeah. Very good polo in Cairo. And Alexandria.
Because you had problems sometimes, occasionally, getting teams and things, didn't you?
No.
With the other regiments.
I know Monty's dead.
The long-distance work that you did on these long-distance trips... what was the object of that, the long-distance ones?
Well, I suppose, again, it was opening up the country. You see, they had, in Egypt that time, there were a lot of very keen explorers who worked in, I've forgotten their names, I mean, they were trying to map unknown territory. And they went in very light cars. And they'd explored a great deal of the country. And I think Paul Hornby's idea was to see whether we could take armoured cars and lorries, you see. So he did that. We explored a great deal in the wake of these other Scholars. And well, we did a great many trips. And I suppose he provided some information, I imagine so.
What ones did you take part in?
Oh, I only took part in one, going from across the Sinai Desert. He wanted to find a route over that. And it wasn't very successful because we spent about, I think we did digging and hiking. We did about 7 miles the first day and about 7 miles, 6 miles the second day. And then we found a hard track and buzzed into El Arish, where Javi Bey was. Had a spend time with him. He's a spendy chap, Jarvis, as said. And he put us on a better, a hard track to come home with. But across the side, and this actually is from the canal up to what is the name of that place? The pass.
Mikla.
The Mikla Pass, which has been so much in the news with the Jewish-Arab war. Well, I would say that you couldn't, in those days, you couldn't get an armored car from the canal up to the Mikla Pass. Doubtless they can now. That was the first reconnaissance you'd done on that route.
Did you, how was it comprised, this trip? Would you take transport lorries with you?
Yeah, I think we took one armored car just for the hell of it, and some transport lorries or something like that. Can't remember more than a hell of a time digging out.
But wouldn't the lorries slow you up?
No. Slow you up if you do 7 miles in one day. It's all digging. Shoving and digging. Going a few hundred yards, getting sunk in again, digging out, going on again. Yeah.
So the lorry would contain...
No, the lorry is far better, you see. Lighter than an armored car. The lorries would be much easier. Mm. Well, I think we've killed that one, haven't we?
How would you say that the signalling thing that you mentioned before, did you have signalling people attached to you during this
yes.
period?
Yes, we had these signal troop. Our signal troop, which was commanded by, put the thing down. Signal troop, I think it was G troop, part and parcel regiment. It was commanded by Monty Hepper. Who I think became, he said he became a brigadier afterwards in the signals. I'm not sure he didn't become a major general. While in England, F Troop was commanded by George Balmain, the 11th Hussars. And when the 11th and 12th changed hands in 1934, the signal troops stayed. Monty Hepper stayed at the 11th, and George Balmain stayed with us. Stayed with us in Tidworth, and they were absolutely first class. Now the men were first class. The men were part and parcel of each regiment. The only thing was, it took them Monty Hepper's lot a little bit of time to become 11th Hussars, and took George Balmain's lot a little bit of time to come to Lancers, but soon they all became completely incorporated. And when we started the important role of using radio communication inside the squadrons and armored cars, the signals troop were teachers and backbone.
But out in Egypt, they were what still?
They were there, you see, in Egypt. They were at regiment headquarters. They just had two sets, very powerful sets, which would do a real link to, they used to practice that, a real link to a dummy command. Possibly they did it to BT Egypt. And the forward link would be to any air or anything else, air cooperation, you see. And of course, actually, they used to practice, they were very professional, these signal troops. And I remember one Christmas, they managed to get, raise some G troop, raised F troop, from Helmier to Tidmouth, between the two regiments, pass messages, which is a pretty, fairly useful thing. But actually, the mysteries of wireless are a pretty well sealed book to me.
While we're on that subject, when was it when you went back to Tidworth, how did the training of the 12th Lancers take place by these people then? What did you actually do?
Well, what happened then, you see, was we took over the Lancer armoured car. It had signal equipment. We took over that, and then we started an intensive course of training radio operators. I've forgotten how it was. I suppose some of them went away to various signal courses. They must have done, yes. And then I think we set up, you see, once they were trained as instructors, then we could set up our own little signal school run by our instructors and supervised by the signal troop. And we then became tremendously radio conscious. Herbert Lumsden, or Dick McCrary, was then commanding. And we did masses of schemes. Really, our schemes in England were mostly signal exercises, skeleton schemes. And radio procedure and we did get very good at it. Then when we changed from the Lancaster armoured car to the Morris armoured car, which was hardly an armoured car, it had very small, very, very thin armament. Very thin armour and no armament. The main thing was that they had a most marvellous set, the number 9 set, which was new, and I think we were the only regiment to have it at the time. That was a marvellous range, marvellous set altogether. And we went on with this signal communication, which we pretty well perfected. So most of our schemes, most of our exercises in Tidworth were very widely ranged in order to stretch and to learn how far we could stretch our communications.
Did you have a code? Did you work out a code? Or?
Well, there was always an army code, wasn't there? I mean, the signals code. And it became more and more complicated as the war went on. Yes, I think you're very... well, I suppose in those days, of course we had a code, a security code, but as some... when the war came, it became... every year it became a little bit more secure. But signals were the basis of everything.
When you did those exercises to expand your radio signaling, yeah, what would happen? You'd send out one squadron would go ahead somewhere, would they?
Well, then send out, you see, squadron headquarters. You would have squadron headquarters, three squadron headquarters, as far as possible away from regimental headquarters, and they in turn would send out their troops like antennae well ahead, you see, and then you see, signals, all sorts of things come into signals. High ground, intervening masses, woods, ravines. You have to learn where you're going to get good signals from. And that again is the question of ground, you see, knowing about ground. And I think that's about it.
Did you...
We learned a good deal about it.
Did you receive special training, the officers?
Yes. We did short signal courses.
At Tidworth?
No, at Catterick, you see, it was for the signals. Catterick was the signals establishment. I didn't myself go to Catterick, but I did a local course in the regiment, you see. I mean, we all did that, yeah. But I never learned how to strip down, or I wouldn't be able to fiddle around with a set. But I just could supervise somebody else stripping it down.
Shifting back to Egypt briefly, did you also have an RAAC? Ordnance people to help with the maintenance of the armoured cars.
Did we? No. No, anything went wrong, we sent them into ordnance workshops. We had our own fitters, our own regimental fitters. The days of what you're getting at is the Remy, that came in the war, you know. After the first year of the war. No, we sent them to ordnance. We didn't have any ordnance attached to us.
Did the takeover, when the 11th Hussars took over from you, did that go smoothly?
Yeah. That was very good, because we're all old friends. And I should say, the greatest thing was the second in command, the 11th Hussars second in command, John Galbraith, who was a wonderful man. He came out ahead, and we all loved him. And the takeover went very simply. And at Tidworth, my brother-in-law, William Brown Clayton, went home. I've forgotten who with. Ken Smith, I think. And that went very smoothly, except one amusing episode was as always, William was looking at taking over some plates in the officer's mess, and he looked at one and it was cracked. And he looked a bit doubtful at that. So the mess sergeant of the 11th Hussars, who I suppose was a bloody rude chap, he picked up a pile of plates and threw them on the floor. And he said to the 11th Hussars, Ken Alexander, looked rather surprised, he said, these are surplus anyhow, and I was going to give them to the 12th Lancers. Now they can fucking well... I think otherwise, the takeover was extremely smooth. And the only thing that made us laugh slightly was that the 11th, both us and the 11th, had handed in our armoured cars to the ordnance in Egypt and Tidworth. We'd handed them in, they were put under lock and key and released by the ordnance to the incoming regiment. But so it happened that directly we got back to Tidworth, we were all going on Christmas leave, there suddenly came a demand to immediately produce an ad hoc squadron to go to the Tsar directly after Christmas. And So we had, none of us had driven the Lancers armoured cars, but that was easy enough. But when it came to rolling out the Lancer armoured cars, taking them over from the ordnance, to their horror and surprise, the ordnance found that they'd taken over cars with no inner tubes. The old 11th had, I gather they'd given the ordnance a damn good lunch, plenty of champagne, and they were taking over the cars. And the ordnance had to stump up new inner tubes for us to go to the Zawis. That is the only funny thing. We're all old friends. We went very well.
The regimental history says that some of your men stayed with the 11th Hussars. About 90 men stayed because they were under-established. Do you remember anything about that?
No, I didn't know that. I didn't know that. They were probably... No, I didn't know that. No, I never missed that.
I mention it because it sort of links with this thing that is also mentioned in the history, is that you were short of men, apparently, when you got back to England.
Well, I suppose, yes, I suppose the thing would be that, yes, I suppose that may have been so. I didn't know. I bet we didn't leave them the best ones. Now, I suppose, no, it would be done by records. It would be people who had just come out. They had to do a certain amount of foreign service. In those days, you did a certain amount of foreign service. So these would be the last joined to the 12th. So they were left behind. They wouldn't be people I'd known, that way, you see.
But were you aware when you got back to England of this sort of problem of manpower shortage?
Well, yes, I suppose we were. But again, that wouldn't be my problem. I was only a troop leader.
Would you say that by the time now you'd gone back to England, as a result of your experiences in Egypt, you were fully expert in armoured cars and armoured warfare?
Oh, yes. I think the best training ground's ever been. Far the best. And the 11th, and they trained, you see, till the war. They had 4 years there. Oh, yes, it was a wonderful training ground, it was that. No doubt about it. And also, knocking about abroad, it does the troops a lot of good. Oh, yes.